Hello, I'm Claire Wright, Professor of Public Engagement at La Trobe University. Welcome to Literary La Trobe, a podcast showcasing the writing and research of La Trobe University's staff, students, alumni, and adjuncts. The recording you're about to hear is from the 2024 Bendigo Writers Festival. I was fortunate to be the co-curator of the Bendigo Writers Festival in 2024, programming a suite of sessions under the La Trobe Presents banner. The festival took place on the second weekend of August on the unceded country of the Djadjawurrung and Tungurung peoples of the Kulin Nation. Can you understand the heart of a nation and its narrative through the public and personal relationships which have forged a path to both conflict and compassion? In this event, Shannon Palmer, Thomas Mayo, and Tania Rossi look at the relationships at the heart of the social, cultural, and political communication that we need to generate change in Australia, with me, Claire Wright. Please note, some of these live events may contain strong language. I hope you enjoy. Good afternoon, everybody. Thanks for coming to this marvellous session. My name is Professor Claire Wright, and I'm a Professor of History at La Trobe University, which is a proud sponsor of this particular session. It's part of the La Trobe Presents suite of panels that I have, in fact, curated as the co-curator of the festival this year. I'd like to start by acknowledging that we are meeting here today on Djadjawurrung and Tungurung land, that these lands were stolen, that sovereignty was never ceded, and this always will be Aboriginal land where storytelling and words and ideas were central to the country and the people who occupied this place for tens of thousands of years. This session is called Close Encounters, and we're going to address the question, can you understand the heart of a nation and its narrative through the public and the personal relationships which have forged a path to both conflict and compassion? And to look into that, which is essentially looking at, I think, the relationships that are at the heart of the social and cultural and political communication that we have had and we need to have in this country to generate change. Those relationships are really central to it. To discuss these issues, we have three wonderful writers and thinkers. Firstly, I'm going to go to Tania Rossi, who is in the middle there wearing white. I've just discovered that white is Tania's signature colour. Tania Rossi is a cultural awareness and cultural safety facilitator at the Koori Heritage Trust. Tania is also the great-granddaughter of Margaret Liladia Tucker, MBE, who was a significant Aboriginal activist and one of the first Aboriginal women to publish for mainstream audiences. Margaret's landmark autobiography, If Everyone Cared, was republished in May this year in a new edition titled If Everyone Cared Enough. This nationally significant publication aims to reinstate the original words of Auntie Marg, as she was affectionately known, and shed light on the previously omitted descriptions of her culture and personal experiences. We'll dig into that a little bit later. Tania and many others played a significant role in ensuring this edition was true to Margaret's voice. Please welcome Tania. Directly to my right is Thomas Mayo. Thomas Mayo is a Kurrajang... Is that how you say it? Say it.
Kurrarig.
Oh, I really buggered that up. Kurrarig Aboriginal and Kulkajal Irrumbal. Oh, can you
Kulkajal Irrumbalay.
Okay. That's appalling of me, and I apologise, Thomas.
No, you're right.
He lives on Larrakia land in Darwin and is the elected Assistant National Secretary of the MUA. Thomas has more than 20 years of experience in leadership and advocacy, including the development of the Uluru Statement from the Heart in May 2017. He is a signatory to the Uluru Statement and has been a leading campaigner for its proposals for a voice to Parliament and a Makarrata Commission. Thomas has been a board director at Australians for Indigenous Constitutional Recognition since 2019 and the Indigenous Literacy Foundation since January this year. He is also on the steering group for the First Nations Clean Energy Network, influencing clean energy policy and supporting the Indigenous peoples and their communities in policy development, energy access and negotiations. Thomas is the author of seven books, written since 2019. have you know, and has also in that time written many articles and essays published across the major media providers. In 2024, Thomas is publishing two new books, a children's book about the Torres Strait Islands flag, which was published in May this year, and a book about how the campaign for peace and justice for Indigenous people continues after the referendum was lost last year. That book, which I have a sneak preview of here, will be out on the 2nd of September. So please all get behind this book, and please welcome Thomas Mayo. To my far right, in geography only, is Dr. Shannon Palmer. Shannon has spent over a decade working in community engagement, facilitation and research with First Nations people and communities and government and non-government organisations in the arts, cultural and cultural heritage sectors. Shannon was awarded the 2023 Prime Minister's Literary Award, on which I was a judge, so I actually have read this book prior to this session, for her book Unmaking Angus Downs, Myth and History on a Central Australian Pastoral Station. She also won the Ernest Scott Prize, which is awarded annually to a book based on original research, judged to be the most distinguished contribution to the history of Australia or New Zealand, or to the history of colonisation. So she's perfectly suited to this conversation as well. Please welcome Shannon. Tanya, I'd like to start with you.
Okay.
So, this book, which Margaret Tucker wrote, seems to me to be the heart of the conversation that we're having. It is written in Margaret's own voice.
Yep.
But her voice has required some amplification to get it out there to a wider audience. Can you firstly tell us about your relationship with Margaret Tucker, Aunty Marg, as you know her?
Aunty Marge was my nan, my great-grandmother, so I was raised with her. She actually passed away the year just before I got married, she did. She was my nan. Grew up fondly with her. She passed on lots of wisdom, lots of great words. If kids grow up and they want to be, you know, doctors and teachers and everything, and I remember, a lot of the times, particularly in my teens, thinking, I want to be like her. If I could acquire any attributes, it would be to be just like her. And I couldn't put a finger on why or how or what it was about her. In my senior years now, I know what it is. It's that grace and it's that perseverance and I think for my nan, it's that just, what's the easiest way to put it for me is always being positive. Always there's a positive and a negative, and that's what I took from my nan. And as much as you can have a hard story or a hard tale to tell, there's always good that will come of it. It depends on how you see it, the way you take it in and absorb it, and the way you deliver what comes next is the biggest message. And for everything that she endured and everything that happened to her, to be the woman that she was her whole life, I've never met anybody who hasn't taken something from her or said, what an angel in disguise. A true substance of just, I don't know, she's just an amazing woman. Mm.
Can you give us some of the nuts and bolts of that story, of her life?
So Nan was born in 1904 on Warringesda Mission up. Well, there's some people say on Warringesda Mission, but her story depicts that she was born on the Murrumbidgee River at Darlington Point, which is about 20 minutes from Warringesda Mission, and that's where Nana Teresa met Grandfather William Clements, and he was a Wiradjuri man. So my nan was born on Wiradjuri country, and then my Nana Teresa was moved down. They sort of moved around from Munakulla to Warringesda to Cummeragunga, and so my Nana Teresa was moved down to the Cummeragunga Mission, where she had two more girls, and then had the last daughter, Aunty Jerry, back on Warringesda. So for our culture, we've always been raised with the women's side, the Yorta Yorta and Wiradjuri side. So my nan was in Munakulla at the time when she was 12, when the welfare came into the schools and removed her and her sister May and a cousin. And if anybody has seen Rabbit Proof Fence, that part of the story where they actually take the girls is a bit of a rendition of what my nan's story was after speaking with a cousin of mine who played a bit of a role in that movie, said they sort of got that scene. As much as it was a story of thousands of our children, it sort of they got it from Nan's book when she actually did the first edition. So she was removed at the age of 12 and sent to Cootamundra Girls Domestic Training Home, where she resided for about 4 years. And like those girls, she did try to run away with her sister and a couple of the other girls and were caught and taken back. And then she was put into Sydney in a middle-class white home, where she looked after 3 children and maintained the premises. My Nana Teresa did find her girls. She was a persistent little woman, I've been told. She was 5 foot nothing but strong as an ox. Found her girls and appealed to the Aborigines Protection Board to have them removed and sent to another home, because when she visited my Nan says in her book, she says she said, "I didn't tell my mum how I was being treated because I didn't want to upset her and I didn't have time," she said, "but my mum just must have had this mother's intuition and knew something wasn't right." So my Nana Teresa did come back and she got my nan removed to another home, which was much nicer. And then she talks about her story with her sister and how sometimes they would sneak out and go to a party or two, or they'd go have picnics and meet up. So, yeah, and then how she didn't go back to the mission, or she didn't go back to her mum's country. She ended up residing in Melbourne and started her work with activism and fights, you know, for her people. And not just her people, people around the world. Mm. Hence is why she got the MBE, because she did a big movement in the 1930s and marched down to the German consulate to fight for what was happening with the Holocaust. So she did work right across the board. She was just human rights in general. Didn't matter, as her words were, if you were black, white or brindle, people were human, and she fought for that.
I'm going to come back to that point a little bit later on, but for the moment I'd just like to stick with her life story, and particularly the book.
Yeah.
And as I was saying before, If Everyone Cared was first published in 1977. Yep. And it was a landmark publication at the time. It was really reaching out from a silence. You know, W.B. Stanner, the anthropologist, called this the Great Australian Silence. Mm. And here was not only somebody in the 1970s, which is before historians, this is pre-Henry Reynolds, really, are starting to reach out across from the other side of the... to tell the story of the other side of the frontier. But here was a black woman doing it and telling her own story. Can you give us some sense of why she wanted to do that, and particularly how she did that?
Well, I think she just wanted to... It comes down to that voice, to have a voice for her people and to have to start telling the story of the history of Australia and what happened to her people. And, you know, I don't think she sat down and said, "I'm going to do a book." She used to just write in a journal. That's how the book came about, the yellow notepads. She would just write every day a little story of something, and we've got about 17 of them that have all been collated, and sheets of paper. So I don't think she ever sat down to say, "I want to do a book and get it out there." I think it was more her and her thoughts to pass down to her family, and hopefully somebody would read them one day, which is what somebody said to me when we published the book. There was a woman that came to me, and she'd known Nan in the younger years from the Moral Remarmit, where she wrote the book. And she said, "Tanya, you know, your Nan only ever wrote these down for the family. She wanted to just used to know her story." And she said one of the things she said to her was she was frightened that her family would never know, her grandchildren would never know the extent of the work that she did. And the woman said to me, she goes, "To know that her, not only are her grandchildren here today, but her great-grandchildren and her great-great-grandchildren are here still telling her story, would just blow her away." Because I don't think it was with any intention to have something on a large scale. It was just her writing her thoughts and her voice.
So did somebody help her facilitate? I'm thinking in particular, was there sort of a white ally who...
There was. So it was when she was with the Moral Remarmament, the people there at the time were helping her. And there was a lady, and it's really terrible of me, I should know it off the top of my head right now. It was her best friend, Nola, I think it was, Nola Turner, I think it was, who said to her, you know, no, Marge, we should put this into a book, and that's where it started. And she said, yes. So they did.
Yeah. Thomas was on a panel in here this morning. Some of you might have been in it, that was called When Two Heads Are Better Than One. It was about the importance and the possibilities of collaboration. And Thomas was speaking with Kerry O'Brien. We'll get back to that. But, you know, clearly Marg was a trailblazer in the collaborations that were possible. Mm-hmm. And we'll talk with Shannon a bit more about cross-cultural collaboration in a minute as well. Yep. We'll get back to Marnie Marg's story book a bit later. But, Thomas, I'd like to move to you. I've just said you've had seven books since 2019, which is an extraordinary output. One of those books that you were inspired to write, which was your first book, was Finding the Heart of the Nation, The Journey of the Uluru Statement Towards Voice, Treaty and Truth. And you wrote that after you were entrusted to carry the sacred Uluru Statement from the heart, the canvas, the actual document that everybody who had been at those dialogues signed, and you were there. And you carried those around to Australians from all walks of life soon after its creation in 2017. I want to ask you, first of all, that statement says you were entrusted to carry this sacred document. How did you win that trust, and from whom, and why you?
Yeah. So I was a Wharfie and then a union official, and it was through... And it goes to Arnie Marg's story, I think, as well. Like, listening to Tanya, I think it's so right that, you know, this is something that is really, you know, based on her life, I think, because we were talking earlier, Tanya and I, about the solidarity with the union movement, but really reaching across, you know, a cross-section of politics or allies, and so that was really inspiring. And so I was a union official. I was an activist in our community, organising rallies and everything like that, and was chosen, elected to go to Uluru. And the reason why I was entrusted with the Uluru Statement, it took a couple of months for it to be painted. So, as you could imagine, you know, we didn't know what the outcome would be at Uluru. And Rachel Perkins was the one that, with Noel Pearson, came up with the idea that they wanted artwork to go with it, but in the tradition of the Yirrkala Bark petitions, but none of the artworks that were there really were about the moment. So instead they got this blank canvas. And if you look carefully at the high-res images of the Uluru Statement, you can still see the pencil marks where we signed within that rectangle, basically. And then the statement was printed in the middle, and then the artwork was painted. And the first time I saw the Uluru Statement was the painted version, the canvas, was at the Garma Festival. And I was fortunate that I had the support of my union, the Maritime Union, to campaign full-time for what happened at Uluru. Arnie Pat Anderson, Noel Pearson and Professor Megan Davis met with myself, our National Secretary, Paddy Crumlin, and the Deputy at the time, Will Tracy, and said, can we have Thomas? Can he help us out? So I was just full-time on the job by the time Garma came around. And I asked Marcia there, Marcia Langton, I said, this object here has great power. You know, I could feel it on the stage when we held it, when they were talking about it. It was a panel. And so that's how I was entrusted with it. Take it, Thomas, you know, and then I started the long journey.
And so do you consider those people who you've named there, Noel, Marcia, Arnie Pat, Megan... are they your elders, and have they given you an opportunity in the way we talk about, you know, we acknowledge elders past and present. Do you consider them to be your elders?
Yeah, somewhat. You know, Arnie Pat certainly. Megan might not like me calling her an elder, but she's probably at that age where she doesn't want that yet. But great respect for them. You know, I think this is a thing we're talking about, you know, somewhat movements and, you know, how you can bring people together. And our community is, there's many different, there's a great diversity of experiences and perspectives. And when I wrote the first book, something really interesting was that the publisher said, be happy if you can do 9 interviews, because you've never written a book before, you've never interviewed anyone. I ended up with 20 interviews. And then I was worried once I'd done those interviews and started to write them, I thought, they might be all too similar, you know, might get boring, but, you know, this diversity of experiences and the way that colonisation impacted and the different cruelties that we experienced, but the different aspirations and different ways that we had hope. And so what I'm getting to here is we have, like any large group of people, we're always going to have different opinions and everything like that. But I think we saw last year, you know, even those that didn't support the referendum, we were still all marching towards the same thing, and we'll still continue to do that, regardless of the result last year.
So those relationships that you forged with that group around the Uluru Dialogues have become an important, obviously, part of your life. And then you carried that trust and the document itself around Australia, and you met with communities around Australia. What would you say was the tenor of the relationships that you then formed in that time from that initial kind of handing over of that trust? What happened next?
Yeah, it was hard to be, you know, completely straight about just... The Uluru Statement came out. There was, you know, a sort of a media cycle or two about it. You know, it was a big moment. But we see these moments, I think, throughout our struggle, you know, the long history of our struggle. We've seen many of these moments that don't amount to an outcome. And so taking the Uluru Statement around, that was something really difficult to get people inspired, our own people, because we've seen so much heartbreak. You know, as we've seen last year, even more heartbreak. And so that was one of the difficult things. The misinformation was already starting, you know, because of the way that it was reported. But I've got to say this, just I think this is something interesting. The 5 years that I was full-time bringing the Uluru Statement to the people, doing the political work as well to try and, you know, create the opportunity to structurally reform, you know, how we listen to as a people, there was barely any racism experienced about that. Very little vitriol, you know, very little. Social media was a big part of what we were doing because there was no money in a campaign, so we had to use social media to get the message out. And that changed, not really when Albo declared that he was going to take it to a referendum, but the floodgates were really opened, firstly, when the Nationals went against it just before Christmas in 2022, and then when Peter Dutton took a decision to use it as his political opportunity and not something in the national interest and walked away from that bipartisan support for constitutional recognition, the floodgates really opened. And then it was just disgusting. You know, the nastiness, the lies, the personal attacks. And so that wasn't a problem when I started travelling with the Uluru Statement. But it certainly became one when Dutton decided to make it a political opportunity.
I first met you, Thomas, at the Adelaide Writers' Festival in 2017, and I chaired a panel with you and Megan. It was about the Uluru Statement 3 years on, so 2017 to 2020. And I have to say it was an extraordinary moment for me because at the end of this session, we had talked about doing this before, that Megan was going to read the first half of the statement, the Uluru Statement, and then Thomas was going to read the second half. And Megan had it in front of her and she started reading it and then passed it over to Thomas, and then Thomas started reading it and then he just put it down and just continued to recite word for word. And by the end of that session, there were about 1,000 people in the Adelaide Gardens that day. Everybody rose to their feet in a massive wave of applause, mass crying. It was an incredibly transporting moment. It was a powerful moment. And then the main thing that we then went to questions that people said was, what can we do? What can we do next? What can we do to help? How can we work with you? What does it mean to walk together?
Mm. It was the most common question in that time. And I guess just to put some numbers, some analysis behind it, what I was talking about earlier, I mean, it is a very moving statement. And I saw that, you know, everywhere around the country where people were hearing it for the first time or hearing it spoken for the first time. But when the referendum was, when the Uluru Statement came out, it was around 49% the polls in support. By around 2019, it was up to 60% support and around 40% against. A lot of undecided, but it was 60-40 basically. And then that change, as I mentioned, was when the Nationals went against it and it went like that. And then the Coalition formally went for the No campaign and it went like that. And then it was consistently 60% against and 40% for, until just before the referendum, it started to go the other way again. But it was too late.
Mm.
The Uluru Statement, and I talk about this in this book, it continues to be, you know, one of the most eloquent and powerful pieces of writing this country has ever seen, and it is still truthful. You know, and no less hopeful, I think, since last year. And I hope that people will continue to share its words and defy what those that opposed it in a nasty way, those that knew what they were doing. And because I don't have a go at people that voted no. I think largely people were confused and, you know, the fear-mongering got to them. And the slogan, if you don't know, vote no, was very effective. Mm. But I think... yeah, I forgot where I was going. But anyway, you get it, right? We've got to defy them. We've got to continue to have hope. And what gives me hope, sorry, I might be going a bit long.
No, not at all.
Mm-mm. Is that young people voted yes. Mm-hmm. Generation Z voted yes, overwhelmingly, because of the work that educators and parents and people that love our children that are learning differently to older generations, that is making a difference, and they voted yes. Mm-hmm. I also think about Arnie Marg and our elders, you know, that have... tried every time we try to do something, whether it was for equal wages or for to get a right to vote or, you know, for equal citizenship rights, the 67 referendum, the answer was always no first.
Mm.
And they eventually achieved what they tried to do. So we can have hope. And lastly, because certainly, despite the disinformation, a majority of Indigenous people voted yes. Mm. And that is absolutely clear now.
Mm. Yeah. And I guess that's why I wanted to raise that point about what happened in Adelaide that day, is because I've found it really inspiring, the courage of the Uluru Dialogues to continue to say, well, 40% of the nation did say yes, and that's 6 million people, and we can work with those 6 million people who are still going to have that question, what can we do? Yep. And so I think that there's still, it seems to me, that there still is an appetite for that. How do we work together? What can we do still, the people who voted yes, to continue to work towards justice?
Well, the very first thing is, and the very first chapter is hope. We've got to dust ourselves off, as Indigenous elders did all those times throughout our history of struggle. We've got to dust ourselves off and keep going. Keep having conversations as if we're still in a campaign. Familiarity is something that was lacking. It's easy to believe a vicious rumour about a stranger than it is about a friend. So we've got to introduce people to the truth about Indigenous culture. The most passionate supporters that had never been involved in a political campaign were people that had just been on country, you know, on a holiday, that had sat in the sands around Uluru experiencing our culture and becoming familiar with us. So they had a resistance to the lies that were told about us then. Those are two very important things. And finally, I think, and again, listening to the story about Arnie Marg and how she was just taking notes and hoping that her children would read it, the other thing I say is, let's write our experience of last year. You know, let's record our experience of last year. Whether you think anyone's going to read it or not, let's record it, publish it if you can, but we've got to write the truth of what happened last year not those naysayers and those bad actors that fought against it.
Two words there that came up in what Thomas was just saying, beautiful segues to you, Shannon. One of them is dust and the other one is friends. And Shannon's book, Unmaking Angus Downs, traces a history of colonisation in Central Australia by tracking the rise and the demise of a rural enterprise across half a century. That's Angus Downs, that great station. And the complex and the creative practices that transformed that cattle station in country. And you really grapple with the question of how people experience their profound dislocation and in place and how to make a place for themselves in the wake of that rupture. You embedded yourself in country. I don't think speak fluent Pintajara, but you're capable in it and had a translator with you, lived with people, forged relationships with Anangu people. And I remember one of the things that we wrote in our judge's report about your book when we were awarding it is, and I'm going to quote, "In an age that calls for truth-telling, Shannon models an exemplary act of truth listening." Tell us about how you became a truth listener.
Okay, so, I mean, Unmaking Angus Downs, the book really emerged out of big questions about history, how history has been made and told in Australia. I grew up just down the road from here in Maryborough on Djadjawarrung country, but I didn't know that I was on Djadjawarrung country when I was growing up in Maryborough. It's not something that I came to learn until much later. And so studying history, I had really, you know, I was really troubled and challenged by a lot of the stuff that I was learning when I went to university about our past, and was asking big questions around why there was so much silence in a lot of the history writing that had happened here in the 19th and throughout much of the 20th century. And was thinking really deeply on the methods that historians use in particular, the documentary archive, A Linear Sense of Time, and how, you know, these have created these silences and white noise. And so what does it mean if the historian looks to place and country as an archive and engages with embodied forms of knowledge and memory? You know, and how does the historian go about writing histories of this place that engages really deeply with First Nations perspectives? And so I moved to the desert. Angus Downs became, I came across a really unusual book that emerged from Angus Downs in the 1960s. And I was really interested in that place. And so, yeah, I went to the desert and bought a Land Cruiser and went out to a community called Amumpa, which is really closely connected to Angus Downs. So Angus Downs spans over 340,000 hectares in central Australia. It's situated pretty much between Mabuntwa, the place we now know as Alice Springs, and Uluru. So if you've driven from Alice Springs to Uluru, you've driven through part of what was the station. And also if you've travelled to Wataka, the place we now know as Kings Canyon, you've also driven through a large part of the station. And so when I went out with this book that was full of photographs that this anthropologist, Frederick Rhodes, had written, the book is called The Wind of Change in Central Australia, The Aborigines at Angus Downs, 1962. And there were upwards of 250 Anangu living on the station in 1962 when Rhodes was out there. There's lots of photographs in this book of Anangu who were on the station, many of whom, when I went out in 2012, were still around. Mm. It's a really rare book. No one has... It was published in East Germany. It costs hundreds of dollars to get a copy, so Anangu hadn't really seen it. And so when I went out and started asking questions about the station, everyone sort of said, oh, you need to go and see Chucky Pumpjack and Sandra Armstrong, because they're the two people that have the authority to speak for that place. And so I did seek out and meet Chucky and Sandra. And we started talking stories about the station. They were really interested in the book. I had a Land Cruiser. I took out a loan and bought an 80 series Land Cruiser, which was pretty much the best thing I ever did, because I was able to get people, like take people out on country. And Chucky hadn't been out to the site of the original homestead, Wallara, for a very, very long time. And so it sort of started there. You know, I sort of let them know that I was interested in Angus Downs, wanting to learn more about it. and just started a process of building a relationship with Chucky and Sandra, going out onto country, asking where Anangu wanted to go, driving out onto country. A slow burn as well, and listening was such a key part of it. I did a Pitjantjatjara language course when I first started, and I remember our Anangu tutor sort of saying, you know, white fellas, they go out they're out bush and they just like, they've got their agendas and they talk at everyone, you know, they've got bits of paper and it's just, and no one really listens, and that's sort of what really needs to happen. And so I was really mindful of that when I went out, and was as quiet as possible. I really, really, wanted Chucky and Sandra to sort of shape that sort of process as much as possible and to steer it very much so. And so, yeah, it was listening. It was the kind of the foundation of that methodology, really, being sort of asking people, okay, where are we going to go today? And then Chucky and Sandra always determined what stories we would record together. They were all recorded in language. And so it was this, a gradual process of me really getting to know that place through them, through language in particular, and being in country as well.
And that sense that you just articulated there of white noise, it's a really interesting expression. It reminds me of, I've spent a lot of time in northeast Arnhem Land. I have a book coming out in October called Naku Daruk. It's about the Yirrkala Bark petitions, which Thomas has read and kindly endorsed, and which is why he made that reference before. And when I first went out and started living in Arnhem Land in 2010, people had an expression, Yolngu people had an expression for Napaki, white people, but they called them plastic bags. And they said, and I sort of said, why do you call white people plastic bags? And they said, well, you know, they're white, they fly into town on the wind, they flap around and making a lot of noise, and then they fly out on the next wind.
Yeah.
And I was very determined there never to be a white plastic bag. But how, you said then that part of your methodology there for learning, for being on country and for learning, was to be quiet. How difficult was it for you as a white woman to just shut up and listen?
I mean, it was very difficult and challenging in some ways, but in other ways, I mean, it just felt to me like necessary. I was really aware going into that project of how deeply entangled research and colonialism is, and how that deep entanglement had produced so much silence or white noise in our history writing and making in this country. And so I was, with being acutely aware of that, I really wanted to sort of co-create with Chucky and Sandra and Anangu a research process that meant that I wouldn't try to own or consume the knowledges that we were creating. And so to me it was really necessary to be quiet. And in many ways, I mean, it was... when I first started going out onto country with Chucky and Sandra, I just had no kind of way to sort of comprehend where I was, really. All I could do for me was to be quiet and learn, because it was so instantly sort of apparent to me that these people that became my teachers read that place in a way that I couldn't possibly comprehend. It was kind of like, I did sort of hard to describe, but yeah, it just sort of became a necessity, challenging, but.
Yeah, I'm not saying that plastic bags aren't a thing, you know, the white plastic bags, but I think it's difficult for, whoever we are to really listen. And I learned that when I wrote the first book and I was doing interviews, and you're interviewing someone, and then you sort of can't help doing the equalising sort of thing that you do in a conversation. And it's like you have to learn to actually just shut up, and let the person talk. You know, it's a skill, I suppose, and something, about being self-conscious of how you're interrupting someone. Yeah.
It's very easy to jump into the silences.
Yeah.
And, I've certainly found this in collaborating with First Nations people, with Yolngu people on this book, is that part of listening is being comfortable with the silence that just can exist while people are thinking or contemplating. Sometimes when I'd sit down with one of the old people he'd just start singing, and gently to himself, and he'd say, and then he'd come back into the room or stop singing, and he told me that he had just been on country. That was him singing his way back onto country. Mm-hmm. And but from my perspective, both as a researcher and just in the sociability that I'd been grown up with, I had no reference for that in the same way that you sort of suggested you had no knowledge of where you were on the land if you didn't have a GPS or somebody to guide you.
Or any way of making sense of it or being able to read it, whereas someone like Chucky clearly did.
So I want to pick up on the point we started with Thomas about him being entrusted to carry the Uluru Statement. Shannon, how did you win the trust of Chucky and other people to even be with them, for them to spend this time with you? I know the Land Cruiser is a great resource.
Yeah.
but certainly for them to then start to tell you stories and to transfer cultural knowledge required a relationship of trust. How did you build that relationship?
Yeah, I mean, it was a long, slow process, and it really required patience and that awareness that the trust was something that I did have to earn from them, because they didn't know who I was, and, you know, the plastic bag thing, white fellas do come and go all the time. I think the fact that I was interested in the station was something that was of great interest to Chucky and Sandra, the two Anangu that I worked really closely with, and other Anangu as well. You know, I did sort of think about before I began how this process could also be of mutual benefit, that it wasn't seeking to just take, but so going out onto country, recording oral histories in language, making those accessible. So talking about that with Anangu to begin with, and I just had to keep going back. And it was that process of sort of going back regularly, sitting down with people, having a chat to Chucky and sort of saying, you know, like, where would do you want to go out into country? Where would you like to go? And just kept going back. And, you know, I think after a, you know, both Chucky and Sandra, the two people that I worked with, they were on a mission to have their knowledge recorded. Chucky was approximately 85 when we started working together, which is really old, you know, for Anangu in the desert. His life story went back to a time before white fellas had even begun to infiltrate the desert. He was absolutely on a mission to have his story and his knowledge of that place recorded, and so was Sandra. And so even though I was interested in the history of the station, they had their own agenda and their own mission, and I think for them they saw that I was a vehicle for that. I had turned up, and I
literally
think, and because I kept going back, and, you know, as we were doing stuff, I was sharing it with them and always checking in. And so I think, you know, over time they just developed this sense that I was coming at this from a good place, and that I had their experiences and their interests at heart, and that just, the trust just sort of blossomed or grew from there.
Tanya, you mentioned before that Aunty Mud, her intention in publishing and in getting Nola to help her to turn her diaries into something that could be read by other people was to tell those stories for generations to come. I'm interested in looking at that from the other point of view, from the point of view of those generations. How important is it for today's First Nations women in particular to remember those strong black matriarchs of the past, like Aunty Marg, and to understand their stories?
I think that's probably the... I struggle a little bit. I sit in the middle of the old generation and the new generation, and so... For me, I don't think my nan ever presumed for it to get this far or to be still continued and talked about. It was just, she was just putting her thoughts on paper. For me, and it was Dr. Jennifer Jones, actually, from La Trobe, who actually pushed this. She started this whole process of republishing my nan's book. What I've learnt along the journey of doing this, because it's taken 7 to 8 years to have this book done, is I had to go on my own journey, and particularly to go back, because I didn't ask all these questions when I was a kid because we didn't want to know all the, you know, we don't ask questions when we're children, you know, we wait until we hit 50 and go, oh, maybe I should have asked that question, you know. So that's been a real big journey for me because I lost my mum 17 years ago too to breast cancer, so I've had to do this on my own and go back. And I think that's the key. It's really important that we have these stories because I think it's our generations to come that need to have these stories. They need to always remember where it began and where it started and where this resistance and where this resilience come from, and that we don't need to... I'm a big believer and we don't need to... I think that our newer generations are trying to create a new history where I think we should be an extension of what's already been done. They've already done a lot of the hard work. My nan, their grandfathers, the ancestors before us have done all the work for us to get here today, and we need to go, well, how do we take this and be another branch on that tree of life kind of thing? Not chop it down and restart again and do something different, but let's use all that strength and resilience and power there and enable it and push it forward here. So I think it's opened the doors a lot for women today. You hear a lot more women, you know, out there speaking, telling their stories. But I think women in my communities and my family, it's always been the women in my family who've been that strong backbone. I think these stories are opening the doors for our men to step up to now that have been so diminished and so squashed and so... emasculated for so long that it's given a window of opportunity for our men to stand up and go, we can do this as well. And it's just, I think it's really important that these old stories keep being written down and told. And there's so many more out there that are coming up now and being published. And I think it's education. When we were talking before about how do we get this word out with that, the yes vote and the no, and, you know, it's all about education. You know, when I was younger, I used to talk to my nans about being bullied at school for being an Aboriginal person. And, you know, my nan always said, you know, you can't be blamed for what you don't know. You know, you only know what you know until you know different, and then you have a chance to become better. Then if you choose not to do better, then that's just ignorance. So, you know, we're always learning, and we can read anybody's story and learn from it, absolutely. So I think it's important that we keep... I think it was important what you said, Thomas, about just write it down. Write down what's happening today because that can be used in the future. And someone once said to me, you know, if you had the opportunity to meet your great 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 grandchildren, would you not love them and treat them as you would your children that you can see today? So what are we doing for those generations? It's our responsibility to leave something for those children. Just because we're not going to meet them doesn't mean we don't have to leave them anything. So I think that's sort of what my nan's story did and why I had this perseverance. And I did it for my mum because my mum started it and I wanted to finish it for her. And it's just that perseverance that now I know that my great-grandchildren will have some connection to picking that book up one day and saying, that's my great-great-great-grandmother, as I did. And they might put it in their little kids' school bags like I did with my kids and say, let your teacher read this book, you know, and that's how we get it out there and keep it told, the stories. Mm. Mm.
Thomas, listening to Tanya there puts me in mind of another one of your books that I hadn't thought that I'd mention in today's session, but that's your book, Dear Son, because that your point about... that Aboriginal men have been, what did you say, squashed down?
Was that emasculated.
Emasculated, yeah. Down and... So Thomas has another book, Dear Son, where you can talk about it. And it is about writing something down. It's about fathers writing letters, Aboriginal fathers writing letters to their sons. And tell us why you wrote that book, why that was important.
Yeah, I mean, it came out just when COVID hit, so it didn't get a good launch. But the book was, it explores the things you're talking about, partly in that there has been a purposeful disempowering and degrading of Indigenous men to be able to take advantage of our land and our families, you know, our labour. That has happened over a long period of time. Mm. But it also addresses our, you know, our poor behaviours, you know, toxic masculinity, So it's an anthology of letters from fathers to sons and sons to fathers, all First Nations men. And it's bookended with a long letter to my eldest son. I've got 5 kids, so I thought I was qualified to write a book about children, about fatherhood. So it begins with a letter to my eldest son. He's 24 now. And a short letter to my father to finish it off. And when I was writing the letter to my son, when I was drafting it, I was, towards the end, I give some advice. And one of the pieces of advice that I gave was that we should have an open mind and consider other people's perspectives. And at that point, I was only going to do like a short book. I was inspired by James Baldwin's The Fire Next Time, if you know of it, and those 2 essays. So at that point, I thought, I need to invite other men to write in this thing. And so they wrote Stan Grant, Troy Cassadaly, and 10 other Indigenous men that you may not have heard of. They wrote letters as well. And I'm really excited it's going to be made into live theatre. Mm-hmm. So Isaac Dandrick and John Harvey are adapting it now for the first season will be in July 2025. But it is an important thing that we need to talk about as well, you know. Mm. Not just us confronting our poor behaviours that might have been passed on culturally, you know, as in the bad ways that how we treat women and things like that, but also what we can be proud of as Indigenous men. Mm. And so it's quite a defiant book in that sense too.
Can I just say something?
Yes, of course.
I didn't know that. I read that book and yeah. It brought tears to my eyes, and when you just said it, I was like, oh, that's Thomas Mann. And I'm just like all of a sudden starstruck. Like, oh,
yeah, that's the Bendigo Riders. Close Encounters, right here.
No, I love that book because that book actually made me start thinking about not a diary for each of my kids, but leaving something for my kids that when I'm gone, they will have something, a little bit of me that's a personal thing. Because we don't have an understanding of what our parents do. They just say, oh, it's just mum and dad, you know. Mm-hmm. They're just doing that. Mm-hmm. Until they're gone. And then you go back and go, wow, why didn't I know? And it was a hard lesson for me to learn to lose my mum at such a young age, at 35, and, you know, then sit here and go through a journey and go, what would she have done? What would she have thought? Mm. So that book, when I read that, I'm like, I gave it to my neighbour and said, you've got to read this book, you'll be crying. It's so nice. But thank you. It was a special book. Thanks. Very beautiful book, yeah.
I will just add too that, I mean, that was a key motivation for Chucky and Sandra working with me as well, creating this whole archive of their life stories recorded in Pitjantjatjara that were for their children and their great, their grandchildren and their great-grandchildren. That was, yeah, the number one.
Absolutely. I'm going to move to audience questions now, and we've got about 10 minutes left. This one says, Shannon, this is a question for you, Shannon. You talked about recognising that there are such different knowledges and the difficulty of crossing those boundaries. So the question to you is, how do you know what you don't know, and how do you sit in that space?
Oh, that's a really good question. How do you know what you don't know? I mean, and it's sort of like a chicken and an egg kind of question, really. I've been spending quite a bit of time reflecting on this recently. And I think the act of sitting and listening, particularly in language. I did do a language course to begin with, but we did work with an interpreter. And so there was something about that experience of hearing the stories of that place in the language of that place, because Pitjantjatjara is intimately connected to the country in which we're in, which then, you know, I was having to also, sitting and listening in that way, listening to language, having to learn about key concepts that shaped Chucky's and Sandra's world. And so the more I sort of immersed myself in that process, the more I sort of found that the knowledge system I'm embedded in became othered, if that makes sense. It's a sort of a complex sort of process to try and tease out. But I think the more I did just sit and listen and really try, like, and listen deeply, and grappling with those key concepts like walcha, kin, jukurpa, the dreaming, and how the ways in which Chucky and Sandra saw the world and Angus Downs, the past, you know, in a really sort of particular way that was radically different to my own, the more I did immerse myself in that, the more my own knowledge system very much became othered. And it made me realise that it is just one way of apprehending the world. And it is a way of apprehending the world that has silenced particular voices and stories. It's a way of apprehending the world that has... that is extremely violent and destructive in many ways. And this became increasingly obvious as the more I sat and listened, I think.
Can I just add something about listening? There's in the Torres Strait culture, you know, we certainly learn this growing up, and there's in language sestaman, you know, which is being observant, you know, respectfully, if I was to translate it. It's a way of being, but it's also a quality of leadership.
I think language acquisition is incredibly important to this conversation. Yep. There was a session across the road about security, which is about actually national security, but one of the people raised the issue of the fact that Australia being so monolingual in general and having basically no knowledge of its own First Nations languages is actually a security issue in so many ways. This is a panel question, so to each of you, if you could share a lift with Dutton or the Murdochs, what question would you ask them? Let's start with you, Tanya. What would you like to ask Peter Dutton?
I don't think I'd ask anything.
Don't want to listen
I'd
to
I'd probably take the stairs and not get in the lift.
Yeah. Wouldn't get in the lift with them, yeah.
I probably would take the stairs. Yeah. I don't, look, you know... That's a really broad question. Mm. It really is. Personally, I'm not a. I don't follow politics a lot. The Voice I did, but I kind of tune out because again, that listening for me, if I take too much in, it just overburdens, and you sit there doing laps in your head. So, when it comes to those sort of people, I would just hear. You're probably not allowed to say, but I'd probably just muzzle them and not want to hear them talk, to be honest.
Pretty fair enough.
So I don't have a specific question that I would ask.
Thomas, what about you?
Oh, look, I had to grapple with this when I was writing this book, you know. I only started writing it in January, so I'd had a bit of time to, you know, think things through and let, you know, the range of emotions, the heartbreak, the anger and all that sort of stuff run its course after October 14. And the original drafts did talk about Peter Dutton and others on that side, but I decided not to. I describe the type as bad actors, you know, people that mm-hmm. would seek gain, you know, whether it's wealth or, you know, about their ego and all the rest, at the cost of others, you know, in such a way as was done. Yeah, so I wouldn't... I have nothing to say to them, I think. I would also probably take the stairs.
Yeah. I think I'd probably be with Thomas and Tanya on the stairs.
Okay, stairs are crowded and
I wouldn't want to give them the satisfaction either of having a shot at them. And I want to say this, you know, if you were passionate supporters of what we tried to do last year, don't let that bitterness, you know, sit in your heart, you know. 60% of people voted no, but a lot of them voted no because of the very effective tactics of confusion and fear-mongering. Mm. So don't hold bitterness towards people. Those that you can never move, of course, don't waste your time if they're racist. Don't, you know, waste your energy and your mental health on them. But find people that you can put your arm around and bring them forward with us.
Mm-hmm. There are a lot of other questions, but I think... There are other questions, but we are out of time, and that's a beautiful place to leave it. So I'm going to just read. There's one comment here that's not a question. It's also a lovely place to leave it. This person says, "This conversation about leaving something for your children and great-grandchildren is inspiring. Thank you." And I think we all share that sentiment. Thank you. Please thank our panel tonight. You've been listening to Literary La Trobe, a La Trobe University podcast produced by Matt Smith on unceded Wurundjeri country. To find out more, visit the La Trobe University website.